everybody's economics would be better if they keep in mind this larger historical, political, cultural context.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Pranab Bardham of Berkeley has recently published a memoir of his life in India, in the UK, the US, many other places as well. And it takes in his career at the frontier of economics. It's called Charaiveti, and he joins me now to discuss what the experiences and the people captured in the book can teach us about where development economics has been, where it might go in future. Pranab, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you for inviting me.
Everyone's thinking, what does that title mean and why did you choose it?
Charaiveti is actually a Sanskrit word. It first was mentioned in a Sanskrit hymn, which, believe it or not, was composed between the 5th and 6th century BCE. Mm-hmm. Charaiveti means in Sanskrit, keep moving. But the context makes it clear, keep moving in search of self-realization. The context in which I mention it in the book, and also then I chose it as the title, which is the subtitle of the book, is an academic's global journey. My life journey all over the world was the context. And that certainly is part of my own self-realization process. So that's why I chose that title.
Is it a recommendation to others as well?
No, not necessarily. Not everybody has either the ability or to inclination to do as much global journey as I have done. So no, it's not a recommendation. It's more about my own journey.
Every chapter of the book takes in some different aspect of this journey that you've been on. Some economists are criticized for having a much narrower set of experiences and ideas about the world than you have. What is it in your background, your upbringing, your personality that has caused you to go on this global journey?
I grew up in a very poor neighborhood in India. Mm-hmm. And then my education, both in India and in Cambridge, England, and then I taught in the United States at MIT, and then I went back to India. I taught in Delhi School of Economics and Indian Statistical Institute. Then I went back to Berkeley, where I had been for many years now. I'd also had visiting assignments in different parts of the world. So my background of going through different circumstances, different contexts, different cultural background, etc., certainly made me somewhat wide-ranging in my interests as well as my outlook. My background and my own inclination kind of converge. I came to economics not primarily as someone right from the beginning interested in economics. I was more interested in history when I left high school, and even in undergraduate college, I was particularly interested in history. But very soon I realized there are many important economic forces that shape history. So that probably shaped my kind of approach to economics, which others may not have. I have interest not just in history, I have interest in politics, I have interest in culture, literature, cinema, and all that. Economists are quite often narrow in their outlook, and partly because the subject demands so much of specialization. That's the natural thing to do. But I think everybody's economics would be better if they keep in mind this larger historical, political, cultural context.
And the story of your initial training in economics, that goes all the way back to the 1960s. You have explored new interests in every decade since then. At this point, are you still excited by new ideas, new questions? Are you still excited by the idea of new work?
Oh, very much so. If I don't continue to be interested in new ideas, new questions, if I don't have an appetite for this, I lose my appetite for life. So yes, I'm always looking for new ideas, new questions.
Your early work in Cambridge, UK, and over at MIT, the other Cambridge, that was predominantly theoretical. I think you were interested in trade at that time. As you say, you always had this interest in philosophy and politics. How important as a grounding for economics do you think it is for economists to absorb these ideas as well?
Yeah, I used to do mostly both in Cambridge, England, when I did my dissertation, and also in Cambridge, Massachusetts at MIT. At that time, I was mostly doing mathematical, theoretical stuff. I published lots of articles, primarily mathematical, theoretical, international trade theory, but also growth theory. Because I came from a background of interest in diverse historical, political, cultural contexts, that interest remained always with me, certainly in my readings, even though not necessarily in my journal papers. And this happened when I was teaching at MIT. Gradually, some dissatisfaction was growing in my mind that I'm not talking about the real world or I'm not dirtying my hands with real data. And this brought a major turning point in my professional life. I left MIT because I wanted to go back to India to lay my hands on data, particularly about how poor people live. And as I already said, that since I grew up in a rather poor neighborhood, I have a visceral sense of what is important for poor people and what is not. So that partly led to my dissatisfaction with what I was doing, primarily in mathematical theoretical stuff.
Yes, I think West Bengal at that time when you were growing up, there was a lot of radical politics, a lot of different views about how the world should be organized. That was probably a wider set of ideas than you would find at MIT.
Sure, not just at MIT, many parts of the academic world. Since quite early in my youth, I had to grapple with the challenges that many of my leftist friends, I didn't quite often agree with them, but I had always to have an answer to the kind of issues they are bringing up. So this is how my interest in Marx came. I became interested in Marx. I've never been a Marxist, but many of my friends were Marxists, and they were very articulate, intelligent people. When I don't agree with them, I have to give them an intelligent answer. And in a sense, that goes back to my coming to be interested in history. And Marx, of course, is a big figure in history. And yes, Marx's understanding of history is economic understanding of history. Because I was grappling with the issues of Marxist history, I became interested in economics. Even though I was not a Marxist, but I could see that Marxist history asks very important questions. And to me, that has been helpful. I'll give an example, even though they may not consider it from the Marxist point of view. Let me give you a very recent book, quite a well-known book now among economists, written by somebody who's a friend and whose work I admire, Darren Acemoglu. Acemoglu and Simon Johnson brought out a book last year called Power and Progress. And the subtitle is Our Struggle with 1,000 Years of History. What is the main focus? They start with their interest in artificial intelligence, latest technology, but then they go back thousands of years and they find whether the use of technology is for a good purpose or not so good purpose depends on the pre-existing structures of power. That is precisely a Marxist question. What is the central core issue of Marxist history is exactly this, this friction between technological progress and structures of power. And I think that remains true even today. I may not always accept the Marxist answers, but the Marxist question to me is extremely important. And in fact, in my book, I describe my participation in a group of social theorists, economists, philosophers, historians, sociologists, who are motivated by the big questions that Marx asked. Not necessarily the answers. The answers are quite often wrong, but the questions remain important. And those questions now need to be analyzed and studied with modern methods and modern data. Going back to your comment about my growing up in West Bengal and being the leftist background, it certainly provoked me because I had to answer the intellectual challenges that my friends were bringing up. So in a sense, I have been reacting to that ever since.
One of your reactions to this was to give up your job at MIT, which must have been quite a sacrifice at that time, to go back to India to do empirical work. What is it about going to India to do that work that you couldn't have done if you were still at MIT?
Right. No, I thought about that quite a bit. This was a big turning point in my life. When I went and told the chairman of my department, he immediately said, nobody leaves MIT voluntarily. But then what I told him is like when lovers break up, you say, it's not you, it's me. What was it about me? I found that if I want to work on India, particularly if I want to work on the lives of the poor in India, I'm talking about end 1960s, early 1970s, most of the data about India and for that matter, many other developing countries that were available were aggregates, macro statistics like national income, fiscal monetary policy, and things like that. But if you wanted to understand at the ground level, the micro level data, there's hardly anything available. Today, of course, with the internet, even sitting at MIT or sitting in London, you can have access to some of the micro data because those are now available through the internet. You can download data quite often. I'm talking about early 1970s and 1960s, there was no data available. And even when data are made available, actually, I found out later when I went to India and collected data, I first looked at official data that were available, but I was not satisfied then. I collected my own data. I did a lot of village surveys. I first started with a statistician friend of mine. I collected data from a random sample of 110 villages in West Bengal and went back to the same villages again and again. And then a later pop phase of my life with an economist, Dilip Mukherjee, I then collected data from a different set of villages, about 90 villages in West Bengal. But I knew that when I decided to leave MIT, I was taking a big gamble. One of my mentors, those Amartya Sen, I remember asking him, this is what I've decided, what do you think? He didn't want to discourage me, but he said, are you aware how much of an academic gamble you are taking? And I realized that I was giving a signal to the rest of my profession, as if I'm not interested in what people do, the frontier of economics. And at that time, collecting data in Indian villages, that is something so exotic. You deliberately don't want to do frontier economics anymore. After collecting data, after analyzing them, when I send it to a top journal, in the beginning, they will say no next day without referring the papers. Oh, this uses Indian data, send it to an Indian journal. It doesn't belong to the frontier journals. I had to struggle. Some of my friends like Esther Duflo or Abhijit Banerjee have told me that you broke the ground for us. Because those days, using data from studies of Indian villages, nobody will publish it. And then finally, I did succeed and published in the top five journals articles with an analysis of my Indian data. But development economics is to be marginalized. Serious people don't do development economics, particularly development microeconomics. There are some people who were interested in development macro, even radical people, leftist people, were doing dependency theory about how countries remained underdeveloped because they were colonies, or even today they are under the inexorable influence of neo-imperialists and so on. But that's macro. But people didn't do that kind of ground-level micro stuff. And that brings me to something that I wanted to mention. My interests, being political, are also what today is called institutional economics. I'm interested in institutions. So let me give you an example. My first major development economics article came out, and this tells you how ancient I am, came out in 1971 in American Economic Review. And what is that article on? Sharecropping. When you discuss institutional economics, you don't discuss sharecropping. Sharecropping happens to be, I would say, about more than 2 millennia-old agrarian institution. There's some evidence that there was sharecropping in China, 5th century BCE. So it's more than 2 millennia-old, but it's an agrarian institution, because institution, to an economist, is about relations. Mm-hmm. In fact, Marx gave it a name. Marx, to me, is a very important institutional economist. He wanted to find out what he called contradictions between relations of production, which are institutions, and what he called forces of production, which means technology. So going back to the Acemoglu-Johnson, this constant friction between structures of power and the progress of technology. I mentioned this in the context that institutional economics takes a more general view of institutions. If you take a general view of institutions in terms of structured economic relations, then we, not just myself, in the 1970s and 80s, were doing institutional economics, even though it was not called institutional economics. Later, in the 1990s, Douglas North got the Nobel Prize in institutional economics, and that came from History of Western Europe and North America, centering on the importance of property rights as an institution. But 3 decades before that, my sharecropping article first came out in 1971, so 25 years before. And even in the 90s, when institutional economics, people are doing empirical work, they're using cross-country statistical regressions. So a country like India, with 1 billion people at that time, was just one point of observation. Whereas we were doing, I think, much more grounded micro-institutional economics, which unfortunately was not recognized later. Today, open any major journal, there will be some articles using Indian data. But those days, so send it to the Indian journal. They will not even referee it. The gamble for me worked, but it may not have worked.
No, and it has worked. And in 2024, partly through your efforts, those who worked with you and those who came after you.
It's not just myself, but many others.
There is now a lot of data, and a development economist sitting in Berkeley, for example, can see the data and do some productive work without ever leaving their desk. Would you recommend that they still do what you did and visit the places to understand those power relations?
Very much so. Very much so. Even the best quality data that I see around do not give a good idea of power relations, historical, cultural, political context. After I started doing my village surveys, I found that economists in the beginning didn't take them seriously. People who did were anthropologists. They had a very rich idea of the political, historical, cultural context. But problem is, that kind of intensive, rich, insightful cultural understanding of a place, they cannot do in many places. So anthropology will see usually concentrate in one village or one tribe, one peasant community. That's all right for them. But when you make an economic proposition, if you say, oh, I saw that in my village, no other economist will take you seriously. So how do you generalize? I edited 2 books on conversations between economists and anthropologists. Anthropologists give us very rich insights, which economists, with their statistics and statistical analysis of the data, quite often cannot capture the nuance of the anthropologist's data. But on the other hand, economists can generalize if they're careful about their sampling and all that. I told you about my first sample was 110. Random sample villages. So if you do your sample carefully, then you can generalize. So I could generalize about West Bengal at least. And this is a problem with even the better quality surveys that economists have today. They give you data about outcomes, not processes. Mm-hmm. When you see things, you are observing outcomes. You don't observe the processes. More than processes, you don't usually collect data on relations. To me, relations of production, which using the Marxist term, or a micro institutions power and power structures, using a more commonly used term, we don't collect data on those, usually. There are some people who do, but most economics surveys, even though they are much better quality today, do not collect data on that kind of micro institutions. It's not they are forgetting to collect this. If you want to collect those, and this I found out quite early in my village surveys, your field survey methods have to be different. Mm-hmm. I'll just give you a very crude example. I go to my village. This is mostly a peasant village. As an economist, I would say, oh, what was the wage rate last week? You did your harvesting of the crop. So what was the daily wage rate that was paid? I very soon found out the answers they were giving me are not correct. Why? Because when I'm asking this question, the whole neighborhood is around. So people are curious what's going on. And some of these people are linked to the landlord who's paying the wages. The landlord has paid you half of what you are reporting as wage because you see the landlord around, he'll get angry. So, you know, very soon what we used to do, I and my team, some questions you are asked at the household level. How much rice did you eat yesterday? There are some questions we asked in the field when there's hardly anybody around. The wage rate question, they'll give a different answer. This is a social context of a question. I could give you other examples where you have to design the questions if you are interested in relations, because relations are delicate subjects. Marxists would tell you relations involve exploitation. And if you think there is an exploitation, the exploiter and the exploitee will give you different answers. Yes, data have improved now. We have good surveys, etc. But I think they're limited in this way that they do not collect data as an institutional political economist, the kind of things I'm interested in even today. We wrote some articles about field survey methods, how they need to be redesigned. I haven't seen much follow-up on those.
Many of the things that you're talking about bring to mind an economist who you knew well, Eleanor Ostrom, eventually won the Nobel Prize. Her interests were not in the mainstream of economics when you met her, but you did share a lot of her interests in topics like collective action,
yes,
didn't you? Why was it such an interest of yours?
Eleanor, I used to call her Lynn. I met Lynn in the early 1990s. And she, by the way, was not an economist. She's a political scientist. She's one of the very few political scientists who got the economics Nobel Prize. So Lynn used to say, you are a weird economist. No other economist shows any interest in my work. You're the only one. I told her, look, I grew up in a very poor neighborhood in Calcutta, or Kolkata, as we call it. So I often found out there are lots of problems for the neighborhood. There are some problems which are beyond their control. But there are many problems they could do something about. But they don't do it. Mm-hmm. They will always talk about it. Oh, this thing needs to be done. So they know the solution. They don't need economists to tell them what is the solution. And yet, they don't do it. Because what common language is called, they cannot get their act together. In technical language, that's a collective action problem.
Yeah.
If economists say this should be done, there's no use. Economists have to tell them why it doesn't get done and how do you organize collective action. So I became interested in collective action, I would say, even as a child, because I saw problems in my neighborhood. At this point, I say, as a political institutional economist, there are three major issues in economics preoccupied throughout my professional life. One is this collective action, and come back to that in a minute. The others are, I've already touched on it, institutional economics, how institutions are important in shaping history. And the third is, of course, inequality. And these, by the way, are related. How inequality affects collective action. I have written theoretical articles using game theory, but I've also done empirical work on collective action. And it's in connection with empirical work that I got in touch with Lynn Ostrom. She was working on management of local commons. in different parts of the world, in rich countries, but also some in poor countries. My collective action work that I got in touch with Lynn about was about management of local commons. If you think about local commons in poor countries, they are vital in the livelihood of the rural poor. So what kind of local commons? Irrigation water, forestry, fishery, grazing lands. These are crucial in the daily life and livelihood of the poor. Just to give you one empirical example of something that I've studied, then I found that in many villages, there are water conflicts among farmers. Some villages, they manage to resolve those conflicts. And some villages do not succeed, and irrigation completely gets in disarray. So this question, to me, is a collective action question. When does collective action succeed, and when does it fail? I went to another state, which is in South India, Tamil Nadu. There, I studied 48 irrigation communities and found out, for example, that controlling for other things, villages that are more unequal land distribution-wise have more difficulty resolving water conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
So that links two of my interests that I already mentioned, inequality and collective action. In 1993, Joe Stiglitz was the editor of Journal of Economic Perspectives, and he invited me to be part of the editorial board. And Joe said, why don't you organize some symposia which are not usually done in economics? So I organized three or four such symposia of articles in Journal of Economic Perspectives. And one of them was on management of local commons as a collective action problem. And I invited Lynn Ostrom to write an article for the symposium. At that time, the whole editorial board tells me, who is she? Because they have not heard of her. As I said, she was not even an economist.
No.
So I had to tell people who she is and why this problem, and most economists haven't given any thought to issues of local commons management. So I had to really persuade them why this is an important problem. Today, because of environmental issues, local commons problem, people understand why forestry, fishery, irrigation, these are important environmental issues. As he mentioned, when Lynn got the Nobel Prize, most economists were quite surprised.
I want to ask you a really big question. One of the big strands in your work has been a comparison of the development paths of China and India, the two huge development stories of our lifetime. Your particular perspective, what does it bring to light in that comparison?
I wrote a book for Princeton University Press.
Mm-hmm.
The title was Awakening Giants, Feet of Clay. So these two giants, China and India, I talk about their great things they're doing, but I also was quite aware of their feet of clay. To answer your question, you see, usually people just compare growth rates and stuff. I'm not interested in that. Lots of problems with growth rate calculation, both in China and in India. So you always take these growth rate calculations with a pinch of salt. But as an institutional political economist, I was more interested in what is it that makes China tick? And even when you say you are a political economist, people, oh yes, China is an authoritarian country. India is a democratic country, though less and less so now. But when I wrote the book, India could be described as a democratic country. I have my doubts today. So people would say, oh, this is just a simple comparison between authoritarian country and democratic country. No, it's not as simple as that. Many things China has done very well in terms of institutions, in terms of governance. Let me give two examples where Chinese governance has shown some strength which other countries could learn from. One is, it may be an authoritarian country, but it's highly economically decentralized, certainly compared to India, but also compared to some rich countries. Compared to UK, I would say China is much more economically decentralized. And the other governance issue is the way they reward bureaucrats' good performance. So you are a local bureaucrat in a particular municipality, and your promotion to a higher level in the promotion criteria, how the local economy has performed under your leadership is a major criteria.
Mm-hmm.
There are, of course, some criteria you and I wouldn't like. How much you have kept the local people under control. They call it stability. How politically stable your area has been. But I'm now talking about the economic performance. Look at that local bureaucrat in India. On what does his promotion depend? Seniority.
Mm-hmm.
So as a bureaucrat, sometimes you do good things for the locality, but that's just out of your own goodness or out of your own sense of self-esteem. But your salary or your promotions would not depend on how the local economy does. But the Chinese, now they're making, even in the criteria, how does the local environment perform is also part of the promotion criteria. These two things, if you think about it, there's no reason why this could not be replicated in other countries. There's nothing about authoritarianism. Authoritarianism is neither necessary nor sufficient for that. On the other hand, some of the bad things of Chinese governance are due to the ugly features of authoritarianism. It's a more nuanced understanding, I think, one needs to see where China did good and where China, in fact, is much worse now. This aspect of repression is much worse under the current leader. I have a more recent book on democracy. It's called A World of Insecurity, Democratic Disenchantment in Rich and Poor Countries. I have a whole chapter on what to learn from Chinese governance and what not to learn from them. Obviously, it has relevance for democratic disenchantment that we see all over the world, including in India.
Pranab, you're a political economist, a very experienced one by now, but you claim to be uncomfortable giving policy prescriptions. Why is that?
Yes, this question has been asked many, many times, particularly in my own country, India. People always ask me, oh, you should be an advisor to the government, you should join this part of the government, that part of the government. I've always very stubbornly refused to do that. Policy economics, as it were, has several levels. One level is a level of policy ideas. And that's, I'd say, in terms of abstraction, the highest level, where the problem is that in the real world, things are too complicated. At the level of policy ideas, even theoreticians, which I used to be before, I've occasionally indulged in theory even now, theoretician has a role. When something is complicated and jumbled up, theoretician helps you in kind of separating out the different issues. So you control for something and see what happens. That way, you are untying the knots. At that level, I have written articles on policy ideas. But that is different from becoming a policy advisor to a government, because that brings me to the second level. Second level, I call it policy blueprint level. It's not actual implementation, but you draw a blueprint. So there also, economists can make very good contributions. The third level is at that of actual implementation. And there, I think economists exaggerate their power.
Oh.
Because actual implementation is quite often, there are a lot of political deals, haggling, bargaining. Economists think they're influencing the politician. Quite often, they don't realize politicians are using them. Politicians know which economist is going to support what they want to do. Politicians are also using economists. It's not just that. I think at the implementation level, economists do not have much clue. Sometimes, not always. There are some smart economists who are also quite politically savvy. But in the process of bargaining and haggling and making deals, and some of these deals are not pretty, I particularly withdraw myself because I'm not good at that. And I have that neither the expertise nor the inclination to do that. I think when you actually advise a government, you may have to go to the third level quite often. The World Bank asked me a couple of times to be the chief economist. I almost immediately said no. Because bad as it is for me to advise the Indian government when I have some idea of how India works, not just economically, but history, culture, politics-wise. To be a World Bank chief economist, in my judgment, requires, since I think you cannot be a good policy advisor without knowing the history, culture, politics of the place. I don't know many of these countries, And so I don't want to be presumptive. Now, this is easy for those economists who think they have a formula. You believe in the Washington consensus. Fewer people do that now. But I knew several good economists who believed in the Washington consensus. So the country doesn't matter because you know what is a good formula. So you can apply. And all you know about the country is a taxi that you took from the airport and your conversation with the taxi driver. And I have always kind of resisted that. And I know many of my good friends have served in the World Bank, including some of the best economists have served there, but neither have nor do I have the capacity nor the inclination to be at least a good advisor.
Pranab, during your career, economic development has lifted billions of people out of poverty. There have been mistakes along the way, but there have also been remarkable successes. Now we reach a point where it looks like one of the greatest challenges in the next few decades will be the effects of climate change, which might push them back into poverty again. And we see in West Bengal, where you're from, there particularly are strong effects of climate change on the poor there. What do you think that economics can contribute to being able to solve this problem?
Since you mentioned West Bengal, let me say that West Bengal is the largest river delta in the world. And the Bay of Bengal is the largest bay in the world. And much of the southern West Bengal and southern Bangladesh, the rise of the sea is going to cause devastation. So those who believe in simple formula, you have to change the carbon price. Yes, let people do carbon price. That's not going to help those fishermen in the villages, which are going to be submerged very soon. Even when it's not submerged, the waters from the sea, salt water from the sea is going to destroy the agricultural land because salt water will be bad for the crop. Carbon price, yes, on a global level, if you can do something about it, fine. But we have to do other things at the local level, and that goes back to my interest in local commons. How do you organize the local people to have community ways of not solving the problem, but mitigating the problem? Abatement rather than solution. So is there different levels of solution to environmental problem? I think the rich countries are defaulting on the pledges of climate finance. Those are very big issues, but for the development economies, the local issue brings me back to the collective action.
Pranab, we've been able to talk about perhaps 5% of what's in the book, so I hope we speak again soon. But for now, thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
The book is called Charaivetti, An Academic's Global Journey. The author, Pranab Bardhan, and it is published by HarperCollins India, and you can audio copy using Amazon, or I believe that there are other online bookstores as well. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, then please review us, tell other people about us. And remember, you can always find all the episodes of Vox Dev Talks at voxdev.org.